Blog Talk Radio.
On the mainstream media about that, except they hint that the teachers are greedy. But listen to what the AFL-CIO says on their website.
What the reasons for the strike are.
And this is by Mike Hall. Chicago's teachers standing strong for better schools and improved student services. While contract talks between the Chicago Teachers Union and the city continue today, the 29,000 teachers and education professionals who were forced out on strike to gain a contract that provides students with the education they deserve were on the picket lines early this morning and then gathered for three large rallies across the Windy City. Excuse me. Chicago teachers want smaller class sizes, investments in neighborhood schools, and additional services for students. Chicago students deserve and parents want smaller class sizes to foster improved teaching and learning. And Chicago teachers are calling for investments in health care, social workers, additional meals, and other programs to ensure that children receive the support they need to succeed in the classroom. AFT president, that's the American Federation of Teachers, President Randy Weingarten says, "What Chicago teachers want more than anything are the tools and conditions to do their jobs and help all students succeed." This morning in a column in USA Today, she writes, "The issues that teachers are fighting for go to the heart of improving Chicago's public schools. Teachers report classes of more than 43 students and not even enough chairs for all of them. And teachers often lack textbooks and other materials up to 6 weeks after the start of school. They are calling for smaller class sizes, investments in neighborhood schools, health care, social workers, meal services, and additional services for students. They want to focus on teaching and learning and have legitimately objected to the district's fixation on high-stakes testing that is narrowing the curriculum and being used to sanction teachers." Zerlina Maxwell writes on Ebony.com that teachers have been unfairly demonized as greedy, but that while the conflict over salary increases is the most reported part of the impasse, it's really high-stakes testing, that standardized test which requires teachers to teach to the test, being the basis for teacher evaluations, that is the most significant conflict. Despite numerous studies showing that this testing is an ineffective method of cultivating successful students, reformers have succeeded in spinning the narrative around to blame teachers and damaging their public image. Meanwhile, Rebecca Mead at TheNewYorker.com also takes a look at the growing demonization of teachers, not just by the far right, but by people with little knowledge of such urban school systems as Chicago, where 80% of the students qualify for free or reduced lunches, which is usually taken to be a measure of poverty. One problem with Chicago schools, like the schools in urban centers all over the country, is that their constituents, the students, suffer from the usual hindrances of poverty, having no place at home to study, having no support at home for studying, and sometimes having no home at all. Another problem is that talk of breaking teachers' unions has become common parliament among the kind of people whose kids do not live below the poverty line, polite Pinkerton agents of education reform circling at cocktail parties, blaming teachers for the failure of schools like blaming doctors for the diseases they are treating. In the Washington Post, Melinda Henneberger writes, If we really wanted to improve schools, we'd do what education powerhouse Finland does, fund all schools equally, value teachers more, and administer standardized testing almost never. On his blog, Teacher X, Chicago teacher Ian Barrett fires back at Chicago Public School CEO Jean-Claude Brizard and writes, "I want to educate Mr. Brizard about what it means to help or hurt our kids. I'm willing to sacrifice an awful lot to protect the students I serve every day. When you make me cram 30 to 50 kids in my classroom with no air conditioning so that the temperatures hit 96 degrees, that hurts our kids. When you spend millions on your PEP programs and there's no money for school-level repairs so the roof leaks on my students at their desks when it rains, that hurts our kids. When you take 18 to 25 days out of the school year for high-stakes testing that is not even scientifically applicable for many of our students, that hurts our kids." So that's something to think about.
Absolutely.
And you have to remember those testing, that high-stakes testing, that's corporation stuff. They have, you know, study booklets and test booklets. That's huge business to be selling that to all states. And you have to remember that one of the first families into testing in the education business. Did I hear you say it? Can I hear you out there? Yeah, you got it. It's the Bush family.
I remember when Neil Bush was, 10 years ago, was marketing books and tests and things like that.
Yeah.
And, well, all of a sudden it became, national law.
Yeah.
So, man.
Testing's big business.
Anyway. So, besides selling guns, which they do, the Bush family, now they sell education. Wow. So, anyway, let us go on. There's a couple other articles I wanted to touch on tonight from this site. And, this is a new Census Bureau report. Says working people can't get ahead.
Yeah, you got that right.
The right-wing economic, this is from Mike Hall in The Economy today. Right-wing economic policies have failed working families. A new U.S. Census Bureau figure showed the share of income going to middle and lower middle income houses fell, while the share of income going to the top 5% went up 4.9%. The census report confirms the trend that the Economic Policy Institute shows the state of working America in 2012, failing falling incomes and growing inequities, inequality rather. And instead of coddling the richest 1%, America needs to return to the principles of prosperity and economics that have historically enabled economic security for all of the growing middle class. I agree with that 100%. Makes sense. The AFL-CIO president, Richard Trumka, said, "A generation after Reagan, and more than a decade after the Bush tax cuts, to the wealthiest among us, the middle class is less and less secure. Median family household income fell against last year and remains 8.9% lower than its peak in 1999. The share of income going to middle and lower middle income households continued its fall, while the share of incomes going to households in the top 5% continued to rise. And the top 20% now get a record high 51.1% of America's income,
wow,
leaving less for the bottom 80%. The one silver lining in the data, increasing health insurance coverage, would be endangered greatly by a Mitt Romney, Paul Ryan White House," Trump added. "And the number of uninsured people fell because of the expansion of Medicare, and especially Medicaid, a program that the Romney-Ryan budget targets for immediate and draconian cuts. And the Romney-Ryan plan to repeal the Affordable Care Act would mean the immediate end of the provision enabling young adults to benefit from their parents' coverage. The number of Americans without health insurance decreased to 48.6 million, last year from $50 million in 2010, and the rate of uninsured dropped to 15.7% from 16.3% during the same period, according to figures released this morning from the U.S. Census Bureau. It was the first time in the last 10 years that the rate of private health insurance did not decrease, and census officials said young adults, under the provision of the Affordable Care Act that Mitt Romney wants to repeal, can now be included on their parents' health insurance plans until 26 years old, and accounted for the largest drop in the uninsured population, dropping 2.2 percentage points. And the new figures show clear and unmistakable evidence that of the current benefit of Obamacare and the need to move forward with the full implementation of the law in 2014. But the figures show the lingering effects of the slow recovery from the Great Recession, with 25 million more people relying on public insurance, Medicaid, and the state children's insurance health insurance plan, Medicaid, while the number of people with employer-sponsored insurance dropped by 14.2 million. The census figures also looked at poverty in the United States and found that while the increase in the poverty level of off in 2011, after 3 years of increases, 46.2 million people, including 16.1 million children, live in poverty, about 15% of the population. A family of four with two children under the age of 18 would fall below the poverty line with a household income of less than $22,800, according to the Census Bureau. That's kind of frightening. I think of this guy who has no clue. I mean, the guy is, you know, he's on Medicaid, all right? And he's voting for, he's a staunch Republican, all right? I mean, this is totally absurd. The whole concept is totally absurd.
Well, he's not a thinking person. He's a political robot, that's all. You have to think before you check off the person you're voting for.
I mean, you got to know what you're voting for.
You know, you don't want to be shooting yourself in the foot, and that's what that guy's doing.
And so many people.
They've done some research on that, why people do that, and they think they're close, you know, that makes them closer to rich people. It's like, you know, the kind of the rub-off that if they're a Republican...
The rich people are just shitting on top of them, but they like the smell, I guess. You know, it's just, I don't understand it. And,
well, they think they're going to make it big, and they want all those breaks when they get there.
Yeah. Okay.
I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, or are they just not very bright? To think
this is kind of similar, but yeah, it's a little more involved. The vast majority of American workers have largely been shut out of the nation's economic growth over the past three decades. Of course, the 12th edition of the State of Working America from the Economic Policy Institute, released today and available online. And the report finds that typical American families added hundreds of extra hours of work each year while also earning better education credentials, yet is still struggling to keep up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, hundreds of more hours a year of work and education.
And even those coming out of college can't get a job.
No,
they go and work in McDonald's after 4 years at college.
Or Starbucks, you know.
Yeah, and they owe $100,000 or more.
The State of Work in America tracks the economic growth of the middle class, finds that our middle-class families with income, we have been an average of $19,000 higher per year by 2007 if the share of growth claimed by the richest households had not grown so much over the last 30 years. Likewise, wealth for the typical American family would have been $62,000 higher in 2010 had the growth in wealth over these same years not been overwhelmingly claimed by families at the very top. And the research also shows that growing income inequality has not been offset by increased mobility. These trends have not occurred by accident. Economic policies have undercut the ability of workers to benefit from economic growth.
Mm-hmm.
And the book also examines mobility up and down the economic ladder, wages and salary growth, and the biggest...
What book is that, Leo?
The State of Working America.
And who's the author of that?
From the Economic Policy Institute.
It'd be nice to get somebody from there on the show to talk to them.
Anyway, you can read a summary of the key findings of the state. Working America, download the entire book, chapters. So if you go to State of Working America, right, and you can just go to that State of Working America, and you can download the entire book or any chapters, an interactive chart.
That's very cool. I bet that's
nice,
very interesting.
Okay.
Oh, did we mention that you said, I don't know where you saw this, that if you support teachers and the fact that they're striking in Chicago, you should wear red on Wednesday?
Yeah, I was going to get to that. It's right here.
Oh, okay.
It's right here.
Because you had mentioned that to
me.
Yeah,
this article, I'm going to have to read this so that everyone can see that.
Okay. This is off the same website, and it's by Jackie Tortora. Wear red on Wednesday, show solidarity for teachers and students. Unions and allied groups all over the country are showing support for the more than 29,000 teachers and education professionals of the Chicago Teachers Union who are forced out on strike to gain a contract that provides students with the education they deserve. National Nurses United is one of the many unions showing their support for Chicago teachers and students. We strongly support your efforts to assure limits on class sizes, which are vital to quality environments, to nurture learning, and your efforts to protect standards to keep experienced teachers in the classroom. The CTU, that's the Connecticut, the Chicago Teachers Union, expressed disappointment in the school district's refusal to concede on issues involving resources for students, job security, and compensation, including the district's decision to strip teachers and paraprofessionals of an agreed-upon 4% raise. AST President Randy Weingarten says no one wants to strike, but no one strikes without a cause. Weingarten continued, "The strike comes only after long and intense negotiations failed to lead to an agreement that would give CTU members the tools they need to help all their students succeed." The AFT, that's the American Federation of Teachers, is asking people to show solidarity for Chicago teachers' unions and strong public schools in Chicago by wearing red on September 12th. That was today. So that's a little too late. But anyway, that's nice to know that... they're so strong, and that another union is supporting them. The
National
Nurses United.
Any day, just in support of those people.
That's really rough to go out on strike when you have kids and families and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So anyway, that's what's going on there. There's a couple other articles I wanted to get to tonight, and what was one of our union.
What's the article you're trying to find for you?
This one here was really bugging me when I read it. Romney ignores 9/11 first responders. Ryan voted against their health care.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
how could anybody,
kind of people
you know, they wave the American flag, wave, but they don't support any Americans.
No, even the 9/11 stuff. I mean,
that's terrible.
Yeah. It says, today, the 11th anniversary of September 11th, this was written yesterday, of the terrorist attacks that killed thousands and destroyed the World Trade Center, Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney issued a statement that forgot to mention the heroic first responders, including 343 firefighters, members IAFF members who lost their lives trying to save others. Of course, Romney has long had trouble recognizing workers who labor outside of the boardroom.
Yeah.
While he acknowledges the attack victims, Romney says, America will never stop caring for the loved ones they left behind. His running mate, Paul Ryan, voted 3 times against the 9/11 first responders health care bill in 2010. What a piece of work.
How can anybody vote for those people?
I don't know. I mean, it's just amazing.
Or support them.
Yeah,
I mean, how could you vote against the first responders who work so hard to
they're
try
horrible,
to save people,
horrible, horrible
and now
people.
They're ill? They need to be supported by us. I mean, I think this is unconscionable. This makes me sick.
The bipartisan bill provides medical monitoring, treatment, and compensation work to emergency responders, recovery and cleanup workers, and community members suffering serious diseases as a result of hazardous exposure resulting from the 9/11 attacks. This bill is named after James Zadroga, a police officer who died in 2006 from respiratory disease attributed to his exposure to the deadly toxins at Ground Zero following the attacks. While the bill did pass and was signed into law January 2011 by President Obama, Ryan voted against it July 29th and September 29th and didn't even bother to vote when it came up to the final passage in December 22nd. However, he later issued a statement, "Had I been president, I would have voted against passage of the bill."
Thank God.
You know, God, you know, it's just like... You know, these guys are going to make you incredibly ill. You know, just as dishonest.
I don't know how people can support people like this.
This stuff again drives me nuts. You know? Oh, my God. And
if a policeman or firefighter votes for those people in this country, they are out of their mind, or a first responder. You know, like an AMT, EMT, or anybody like that votes for Romney and Ryan, they're out of their mind.
Oh, I think so.
They would see them dead in a second.
Oh, they would look at them. Oh, God, yeah. I mean, anybody who's a public worker, my God, you know, if they wrote for these clowns, it's like the sick dude. They got to be sick in the head. So Romney caught crap. Deservedly so from right-wing warmongers like draft dodger Billy Crystal for not thanking our troops in the war during his acceptance speech of the nomination of Commander-in-Chief. Okay. To smooth their makeup for his failure, Mitt Romney issued a statement today regarding the 11th-year anniversary of 2011, where he thanked our troops finally, but failed to mention the first responders, and I mentioned that again.
He just has no idea what he's doing.
Yeah. These are some of these. I'm reading here just some comments on from the Daily Cause that included it. Which is kind of funny. But anyway, I'll go back to the next article. It's this is. I mean, it really just makes you sick to think that these guys can get away with this, you know, and people just
they just vote for them.
I mean, they don't even have a damn clue.
What kind of people they are.
Horrible people these guys really are. I wish you'd refer to last night's show, where we read a rather lengthy article on Mitt Romney.
And who he really is.
And who he really is, which, I mean, his entire career was funded and is still funded by the mob, international mobsters. Okay.
That's what the article claims.
You quote the article, and so I should have quoted it, but I didn't. But nevertheless, it's a god awful history of this frightening guy. And you see him walking around. I mean, the guy's a vulture capitalist, basically. I mean, he's got no conscience. He's some kind of Mormon. All right, which means absolutely nothing to anybody unless you're 1% of the population. All right, but it's like, my God.
And wants to move the capital of Israel to
Jerusalem. Okay, and he wants to go to war with Iran.
He panders to Israel.
The guy is just the ultimate piece of shit. All right, totally piece of crap. All right, I'll be happy to say that anywhere. That he is everything you've seen and read and you know about this guy, it's just, you know, the guy is one
would be one poor choice for that.
And Ryan is awesome. Just, you know, a double turd, you know, so.
Level, and the wage share of national income continues to fall. Oddly, the president has carried out objectively what Republicans want, and clearly that set of policies is not enough. In fairness to President Obama, he made additional proposals that Republicans have blocked. Republicans refused to pass the portion of the American Jobs Act in which the president proposed to give states money to keep teachers in the classroom and police on the beat. While private sector employment is now higher than in January 2009 when the president took office, public sector employment continues to decline, and most disturbingly, with nearly 300,000 fewer in local schools. Were Republicans to defend the approach on the basis of the president's record, then they would have to acknowledge that he succeeded with 30 straight months of job growth in the private sector and a private sector labor market that is better than 4 years ago. But that is not the story they tell on the campaign stump. Republicans could double down on their view that the president's investments in infrastructure or income support for workers would have been better spent on even more tax cuts for the wealthy. Of course, the consensus of those looking at the effects of the American Jobs Act and the Recovery Act show that the most effective dollars were spent on shoring up the incomes of those who lost jobs and on infrastructure projects. The least effective dollars were those going to income tax cuts for high-income individuals. So a switch from the president's course of building an America for the future to the Republican view of subsidizing the lifestyle of Donald Trump would not have made the picture better for getting the economy to grow. Can Mitt Romney do better than President Obama with continuing the economic recovery? Not hardly. Of course, if Republicans continue their obstructionism to block the broader agenda of President Obama to increase investment in America, they will continue to have the recovery Mitt Romney would deliver.
So that's the truth, folks. I mean, it's like, come on. Who the hell is getting along? You know? So, I think we're going to go to, let's have a little music break. And what do you think about it?
Sure. back with us. I hope you enjoyed that song. That's one of my favorites. I love it. Little Honky Tonk. And Leo is...
Finding
some additional news.
This is interesting to read. Why the Huffington Post is yet more mainstream media bullet? It wouldn't be so successful with mainstream corporations if it wasn't. And he talked about how a group of angry bloggers sued the Huffington Post.
Really?
Because they're treated like slaves. And
they're taking this stuff?
Yeah. Says, hey, you get these contracts by telling the truth and being intelligent, right? When you read anything from the Huffington Post, remember that this is the intellect behind it. Sleep well. This interview has to be seen to be believed. Unless you already know that she's foolish, it doesn't take long. And bloggers sued Arianna Huffington after being treated like slaves. And it says, a group of angry bloggers being led by freelance journalist and trade unionist Jonathan Tassini filed a class action suit in New York Federal Court after Huffington sold her internet newspaper in February for $3.15 million without paying certain contributors a penny.
And wow.
Tassini, who wrote more than 250 posts for the Huffington Post on an unpaid basis leading up to the site's sale, that Huffington bloggers had essentially been turned into modern-day slaves on Adriana's Huffington plantation. He said he was suing because people who create content have to be compensated for their work. She just stiffed everybody.
Yeah.
She stiffed them off.
Oh.
Yeah, what a bitch. So let's see. The complainant and his blog and his lawyers knew that bloggers' articles helped contribute to approximately a third of the sale value of the site, which about 9,000 people write for the Huffington Post for free. Tassini has had success in the courts in the past after he won a lawsuit against the New York Times a decade ago. He argued on behalf of the freelance journalist that publishers needed to seek permission from writers if they wished to use their piece for both print and online platforms. The Huffington Post was founded in 2005 by Huffington and Lehrer and initially attracted some high-profile writers. One of them is Ellen Brown. This has contributed a lot to them as well.
She's not paid for her work either.
The bloggers argued that with their help, the site is able to attract higher rates of traffic and therefore revenues, a total of $31 million last year, making it an appealing purchase for online giant AOL. The Huffington Post has said that any action against them would be completely baseless. In a statement, the website said, our bloggers utilize our platform to connect and ensure that their ideas and views are seen by as many people as possible. The statement went on to draw a direct compensation between the Huffington Post bloggers and people who go on TV shows, saying that they do it to broadcast their views to as wide an audience as possible. And Huffington defended her position further when visiting London last month by saying, there's got to be a distinction between everybody who works for a media company and the people who blogs for a media company. Cassini, who is being advised by New York law firm Kuzin Strauss, claims he is angry and will picket her home in his campaign.
Good for him.
Yeah. No, it's so true, though, that, bloggers have been,
really abused.
And
they really should have some protection of the content of their work.
Sure, I mean, writers
It's one thing to have it out there, but then when the person turns around and sells it...
That's the thing, and it makes $315 million, okay?
Based on their work.
That's the issue. They should be somewhat compensated for that. Gun grab. Obama Justice Department ends new due process. The Justice Department has granted the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives the power to seize and administratively forfeit property under the guise of controlling substance abuse. The ruling giants, the ATF power, the ruling grants the ATF power to grant property, to take property from people that have not been charged or convicted of a crime.
That doesn't seem right to me.
The Washington Times gives an example of forfeit and seizure abuse in this case of James Leto, a business owner, that had $392,000 seized because he hired an armored car company that was under a federal investigation to transport money for his business. Imagine that. It's dangerous. It is a dangerous extension of the civil forfeiture doctrine, a surreal legal fiction in which the seized property, not a person, is put on trial. This allows prosecutors to dispense with pesky constitutional rights, which conveniently don't apply to inanimate objects. In this looking glass world, the owner is effectively guilty until proved innocent. Until proved innocent and has the burden of proving otherwise. Anyone falsely accused will never see his property again unless he succeeds in an expensive uphill legal battle. Such seizures are common in drug cases, which sometimes can ensnare people who have done nothing wrong. James Leto found out about his little fortune at the hard way. You know, that when about the $392,000, he spent. He's never. It says, as the Wall Street Journal reported, Mr. Leto was never accused of any crime, yet he spent thousands in legal fees to get his money back. And
did he ever get it back?
I guess so. Law enforcement agencies love civil forfeiture because it's extremely lucrative. The Department of Justice Assets Forfeiture Fund has $2.8 billion in duty in 2011.
Who does it go to?
According to the January audit. Seizing guns from purported criminals is nothing new. Justice destroyed kept 11,355 guns last year, returning just 396 to the innocent owners. The new ATF rule undoubtedly is designed to ramp up the gun grabbing because, as the rule justification claims, the nexus between drug trafficking and firearm violence is well established. The main problem is that civil forfeiture creates a perverse profit motive, while leaving bureaucrats with strong incentive to abuse a process that doesn't sufficiently protect those who may be wrongly accused. And criminal forfeiture is more appropriate because it's tied to a conviction in a court with the options of a jury trial and evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. Innocents like Mr. Leto have to fight against the might of the U.S. government with a watered-down standard that stacks the legal deck so prosecutors can get a quick win. And that's from the Washington Times. Really, I mean, they're coming after you guys. Anyway, it all comes down to itself.
That's right. If they think it's there, they want it.
They get some money there. Yes. Okay. Now, here, this is not in this country, but it has to do with workers' rights. And it's, the U.K., United Kingdom, Britain, is going to shred workers' rights. Michael Fallon, a key ally of David Cameron, who's the Prime Minister, said that the new plan would deal with the burdensome and expensive problem of getting rid of unwanted staff.
Oh, really? I bet he has plenty of staff.
Oh, I'm sure he has plenty of unwanted staff.
Michael Fallon, this is by Rowena Mason, political correspondent. Pressure from the Liberal Democrats forced the coalition to shelve plans for a no-fault dismissal earlier this year, which would have allowed small companies to fire people without blame. Mr. Fallon said the coalition is not going to back to fire at will, but he claimed ministers are still committed to making it easier to sack people. Absolutely, there are going to be changes announced later this week because we do want to deal with the burdensome nature of hiring and firing people and the cost of tribunals, he said. A lot of small businesses are worrying that if they do take on somebody extra, they're not sure whether they perform well and they turn out not to be a help to their firm, that it's going to be very expensive and take a lot of management time to get rid of them. We need to get away from the adversarial, expensive, and cumbersome tribunal system. I don't know what that is. And make it much easier and quicker for people to reach negotiated settlements. Speaking to the BBC, Mr. Ballard admitted that he has a different perspective to his boss, Vince Cable, the business secretary. Well, this is what they're doing. It's a little different from ours, and
yeah,
it doesn't
it's
really...
they got a tribunal, and what they do is they, take a labor board.
Yeah,
you can't just fire somebody at
will. You have to have a reason,
it's no different than us. You know, they hear it, too. I mean, if you fire somebody, you know, for no reason, you can go to the labor department and file a claim in a hearing.
But you can fire if you're downsizing.
No, but you have to give them a reason. You have to leave the layoff.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a fire.
Right.
See, they want to fire you so they don't have to pay you
any compensation
on employment.
I don't know whether that's attached to that in that country. Who knows?
Yeah, I'm sure it is. That's why they want to do it. All right? That's why they just want to. It's another corporate thing.
A corporate gimmick,
they just want to avoid paying anybody.
You know, they don't take responsibility for their employees at all and the time that people have given them.
This is Dan Britton again. It's a brief thing. I just wanted to. The CCTV, which is those, cameras everywhere in Britain.
Oh, yeah, those security cameras?
They're used in more than 200 school toilets.
What?
Yeah, they put cameras in school toilets.
Bathrooms.
Yeah. More than 200 schools are using CCTV cameras in toilets. They're changing rooms. Bigger show today. Total of 825 cameras are located in our toilets or changing rooms of 207 schools across England, Scotland, and Wales. Figures provided by more than 2,000 schools show.
Why?
The sons of bitches are kind of mad.
No, privacy.
No. I mean, but the fact that they're allowing that, just to me, the country, I mean, I don't know what's wrong with those people now. I mean, we're bad enough, but.
We have cameras outside the bathroom, so if there is destruction in the bathroom, we know who's gone in and when it happened.
Yeah. Outside, I can see.
Mm-hmm.
Inside, I can't see. You know, I think that's a total violation of privacy and rights. One other thing, more killing in Obama's war on terror than Bush's war.
Wow.
Yeah. Michael Hayden, former Central Intelligence Agency director, CIA director under George W. Bush, delivered a speech yesterday where he outlined that the ways that President Barack Obama has managed a practical consensus, which has fostered powerful continuity between two vastly different presidents, himself and his predecessor Bush. At the University of Michigan last Friday, according to Wired, Hayden said, Obama came to embrace Bush's positions. Both Bush and Obama said the country was at war. The enemy was Al-Qaeda. The war was global in nature, and the United States would have to take the fight to the enemy wherever it may be. So this quick article just kind of shows that Bush guy saying, hey, this guy's the same as Bush.
Yeah, the foreign policy is the same.
Yeah, it hasn't changed at all. And Obama's education secretary is far from neutral when it comes to Chicago teacher strike. The Chicago Teachers Union went on strike on September 10th. At least 26,000 educators have been taking a stand on the streets for a fair contract and reduction of class sizes, provision of social services for children, halt the expansion of charter schools, and an end to the turnarounds in school closings. The Associated Press reports President Barack Obama's education secretary, Amy Duncan, isn't taking sides in the Chicago teacher strike. It's keeping more than 350,000 students out of the classroom. The AP notes, Duncan's statement, I'm confident that both sides have the best interest of the students at heart, and they can collaborate at the bargaining table. as teachers in school districts have done all over the years, and teach things like that. Well, Obama's education side is only neutral if he believes, if one believes he has no prior experience in the management of education. He's only neutral if you gloss over and omit his history as former chief of Chicago public school systems and then leave it there. Okay, Catalyst Chicago, an independent news magazine, created in 1990 to document, analyze, and support school improvement efforts in Chicago public schools. Covered Duncan's record as CEO of Chicago's public schools. When he was in charge, he wanted to create the best urban schools district in the nation. Fix high schools. He implemented a program called Renaissance 2010, which involved closing schools down and replacing them with new, smaller schools. School staff was fired and schools were reopened under new management. Turnaround schools. Classrooms were infused with new curriculum and material. Education experts celebrated the attention given to often ignored high schools, but problems with high schools were so entrenched and intertwined with poverty that it was difficult to predict whether these efforts would be enough for students. A report published in October 2009 by the Consortium on Chicago School Research at the University of Chicago Urban Education Institute sought to determine what effect this policy of closing schools was having, whether it was positive or for students or not. The report states, since 2001, CPS has closed 44 schools for reasons of poor academic performance or underutilization. In 2006, CPS modified its school closing policies to focus on turnaround academically weak schools instead of closing them. In turnaround schools, students are allowed to remain in the same building while all or most of the staff is replaced. As as of 2009, there were 12 turnaround schools in Chicago. So they replaced the entire staff of these schools and kept all the students the same.
So what was the change?
None. Researchers concluded school closing had few effects, positive or negative, on the achievement of displaced students. Closing did not negatively affect students' learning, nor did it improve achievement of students displaced. Only the small number of students that transferred to academically strong receiving schools and found supportive teachers at these schools made significant gains in their learning. And school closings were a cornerstone of the Renaissance 2010 plan for Chicago public schools, which Duncan then implemented. They are now a major source of contention and negotiation between teachers in the city right now. Rightfully so, because while closings have not conclusively improved students' ability to achieve in the classroom, they have improved rival gang members' ability to clash and fight each other in the schools. In Darien, Albert, a 16-year-old was brutally beaten and killed outside Christian Finger Academy High School on September 24, 2009. Teachers, students, and activists in Chicago attributed his death to the fact that the violence in schools has gone up as a result of school closings that have led to the mixing of gangs in schools. It seems the death was the product of a dispute between neighborhood teens and those from Atclet Gardens who had been transferred to Finger when the school closed to the public housing complex was turned into a military academy. Yeah. Want to read a little more on it?
Yeah.
AP reported
before the 2006 school year, an average of 10 to 15 public school students were fatally shot each year. That soared to 24 deadly shootings in 2006-2007 school year, 23 deaths and 211 shootings in the 2007-2008 school year, and 34 deaths and 290 shootings last school year. It's only gone up. That same year Albert was murdered, Fenger experienced an escalation in the number of fights, staff and faculty had been replaced to improve performance, and the increase in fighting was alleged to be a result of this reform. Another reason why teachers are striking involves tying students' test scores to teacher performance evaluations. This is a policy that has been promoted by Duncan and Barack Obama, through the Race to the Top program. Researchers and professors from 16 universities in Chicago have written a letter to Mayor Rahm Emanuel, Chicago Public Schools CEO Jean-Claude Brissard, and the Chicago School Board, arguing a focus on end-of-the-year testing would result in the narrowing of the curriculum as teachers focus more on test preparation and skill and drill teaching, they argue. There is no evidence that evaluation systems that incorporate student test scores produce gains in student achievement. Assessments designed to evaluate student learning are not necessarily valid for measuring teacher effectiveness or student learning growth. Using them to measure the latter is akin to using a meter stick to weigh a person. You might be able to develop a formula that links height and weight, but there will be plenty of error in your calculations.
We have left 2 minutes left, 3 minutes actually, so if you want to finish.
They suggested using student test scores to evaluate teacher performance would mean less enrichment activities like art, music, and civics and other non-tested subjects. And teachers would be incentivized to avoid students with health issues, students with disabilities, students who are English language learners, or students suffering from emotional issues. Teachers in the fifth grade would actually want incoming students from the fourth grade to have done poorly on their testing exams so he or she could get credit for improvement. A culture of competition would be promoted rather than a culture of learning. Despite the problems with tying student test scores to teacher performance evaluations, the Obama administration's Race to the Top program has provided grant money to states that link the two. As a result, according to the Wall Street Journal, at least 23 states and the District of Columbia now evaluate public school teachers in part by student standardized tests, while 14 allow districts to use this data to dismiss ineffective teachers. Where Duncan stands, and even where President Obama stands, is not unclear. It is easy to surmise what Duncan's position is on the strike. The Obama administration supports closing schools and firing teachers to reform education. The administration favors business policies where unionized teachers are pushed aside and staff picked by city managers are brought in to do their bidding. It supports market-based solutions that do not address the root causes of why children are coming to school unable or uninterested in learning, why children are incapable of passing high-stakes tests, or why parents are not around to support children properly because they are having arguments, are impoverished, and work multiple jobs, or can barely put food on the table each week. Duncan and Obama endorse the agenda that corporate state has prescribed for education in the U.S., a prescription that amounts to teaching students what to think instead of taking time to teach students how to think. Because how students are thinking cannot be measured numerically, in ways that indicate whether certain business investments are paying off or not.
And that's basically...
And this article, it keeps going. It's quite long.
It's quite long, but it's good. And
but you can get this article and it's...
The Dissenter.
Yeah.
To the Dissenter. And it talks about Obama's education secretary is far from neutral.
It's a blog, I guess.
Yeah.
So, very good.
So,
by
yeah.
Kevin Gostola.
Gostola.
Yeah, Gostola. Okay. Gostola.
Well, we've run out of time, so we want to thank everybody. Please join me tomorrow night when we venture into the esoteric areas of our show.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, folks. I hope you appreciated some of the information on unions, and I'll talk to you next week.
Yeah.
Good night, folks.
Good night, everybody.